Welcome to How I Wrote This, a show about writers, their books, and the story behind their stories. I'm your host, Pamela Hensley, and in season two, I traveled to Berlin. Learn what it's like growing up in a divided city, fleeing the country, living here as a Jewish expat. Join me as I speak to winners and contenders of the German Book Prize, the Thomas Mann Prize, the Dublin Literary Award, and the International Booker. Season two of How I Wrote This begins on April 23rd. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Previously on Among Equals.
There were so many people, something like I'd never seen before. And they brought us in like a limo.
1975. Joseph Sanchez, along with Carl Rae, Eddie Comines, Jackson Beardy, and Alex Janvier, attend the opening of the self-titled Professional Native Indian Artist Exhibition at the Wallach Gallery in Ottawa.
So it was just the five boys were left to represent.
The PNIAI had been operating as a collective for just over a year, and they were already seeing the benefits of this coalition.
We all got out, and people are clapping, and, you know, girls are hugging us, and, you know, we were like a 24-year-old man. You know, I thought I'd arrived. That was really a rock star moment for me, where I was just like everybody was... Wow, you know. And the show was very successful. They were, I guess, the largest show that they've ever had in that gallery, Wallach Gallery. We've made that champagne reception, but we had broken a barrier.
Later that year, all seven would again show at the Art Emporium in Vancouver.
So it was working. The rising tide does lift all ships.
That's right. And not only were they exhibiting as a group in back-to-back exhibitions, but they were receiving commissions. Jackson was commissioned to create a painting for the Catholic Conference of Bishops. For his piece, Jackson painted his interpretation of the Nativity, taking a Catholic scene and depicting it through an OG Cree lens. Here's what Jackson wrote for his artist's statement for the piece. We see the Virgin Mother-to-be holding on to an embryo connected to the sun symbol. The mother is also connected to Mother Earth, who is nursing her. On the other side of the sun symbol, we see an elder in prayer, ritually offering a bowl filled with sacred things. You can see the sun symbol is resting on his hunched frame, bearing him down with doubts, fears, depression, and all the ills of his time, his back to the very miracle he is praying for. It will take time for all to fully comprehend this phenomenon which has come to pass. Daphne also received a commission from El Al Airlines for a series of paintings depicting Jerusalem. And Alex, well, he began his mural, Tribute to Beaver Hills. Here, look at this.
Whoa.
What do you see?
Well, it looks like Alex's work. It's abstract and colorful and almost calligraphy, and it's wrapping around a spiral wall under a big dome skylight. You know, from this picture, it almost looks like the interior foyer of the Guggenheim.
Yeah. The mural is painted on the inside wall of a spiral stairwell, not unlike the Guggenheim in New York City, just on a smaller scale. Alex's mural follows the curves of the spiral wall, with each ring carrying a new stage in the story he's telling. At the top, under the dome skylight, he begins with creation, the formation of matter, earth, water. The middle ring, he depicts the emergence of powerful, spiritual beings followed by humans. The third ring signifies people living in harmony with nature and spirits, which ends with the arrival of European settlers and colonial violence. Then, the severing of indigenous ways of being. As the mural snakes around the base of the staircase, Alex depicts the aftermath of colonial violence unfolding in tandem with the quiet resistance, power, and re-emergence of the indigenous people of Beaver Hills.
So where is this?
It's at the Strathcona Community Center and County Hall in Sherwood Park, Alberta.
And anybody can see this anytime?
Sure, if you're in the area and it's within opening hours.
Well, I hope our listeners in Alberta will make the road trip to Sherwood Park.
So, back to that show at the Walla Gallery.
It was necessary. If the work of Native art was going to be sold as equal to all other art in Canada, it needed to be in those galleries.
Remember, Bonnie Devine said it best.
There was an element of cool. You know, what they were doing was cool. And suddenly they kind of broke through this visual that that non-native Canadians had of Indians.
For me, it led me to be sent to Toronto after that with one of the paintings to be measured for the Wax Museum in Toronto, which is really a bizarre thing for me.
Joseph explains his brush with the Wax Museum on Yonge Street.
The Juno Awards decided to have an award for multiculturalism in music, and they wanted a native artist to create the award itself. So I did an oil painting, I think it's 2 by 3 feet, and they had this plaque underneath, and they would give it for 10 years. And so with that fantasy going on, the Toronto Wax Museum called me and said, well, we'd like to make a wax figure of you, because in those days I sported the cane with my long hair and my mustache. It was my real surrealist look. And so they took all these photographs of me dressed in my, what I call my Bob Marley suit, you know, skin tight, white Levi outfit, holding a black cane, silver tip cane, and my painting behind me. So these were like really, really fantasies.
So the group and its members had achieved some sort of celebrity.
Celebrity, recognition, desirability. This is Philip Givick from Toronto's Gallery Givick. He explains the evolving customer base for the group's work.
Well, most of them educators, teachers, are more interested in Canadian culture. There's so many people like that showing more interest. And some collectors, when they buy them, they only buy Indigenous art. They don't buy anything else.
The group had set out to establish a forum and spaces for the voices and perspectives of Indigenous artists. And by 1976, they had charted a path forward.
But?
Well, we'll get into the buts. But first, intros. I'm Soleil Launière.
I'm Ryan Barnett.
And this is Among Equals, the history and legacy of the Professional Native Indian Artist, Inc. In our last episode, Eddie Cobinist, Carl Ray, Joseph Sanchez, Jackson Beardy, Alex Janvier, Daphne Ojig, and Norvan Morisseau came together to form an artist collective. There was power in numbers, they felt, and if they wanted to challenge the arts establishment in Canada, the seven of them stood a better chance if they worked together. This is the fifth and final episode in our series, The Image Makers.
I grew up on an Apache reservation, and humor is just a part of their everyday thing. When if they loved you, you got teased.
This is Joseph Sanchez again.
I think Native people have always used humor as a teaching tool, as well as a show of camaraderie, family love. And it definitely was not any different with the group.
In those early days, the group would meet in the back of Daphne's shop. From there, they would plot their next moves, but it was also where their unique bonds were forged.
Alex and Norval loved teasing Daphne about her English heritage, her regal stature, about being the queen, you know. Alex was especially, you know, he was really great at it, and he really loved teasing her. And in the portraits he did of the group, he depicted her with all this British symbolism in the painting. And me being that damn American was just endearing to me, you know, like, we like you, man, you're just that damn American. So, you know, like, it was I think that was probably started by Alex. In my memory, it was the Norval and Alex that teased the most. And I don't remember very much about the other guys doing anything. But Norval loved to tease Alex about he only made designs. He didn't do anything else. He was just making designs. They were funny guys, and they just loved doing that whole thing with each other.
Early in their formation, this group of seven artists had sent a proposal to the Department of Indian Affairs and the Canada Council for the Arts. They were seeking funding to help support their activities. $10,000 in salaries and $5,000 for materials for each of the artists.
Was that a lot?
Well, in Canada, in 1975, $10,000 was about half of the average income. But it didn't matter. Alex and Joseph recall they were never successful in receiving any sort of government grant for their activities. Alex remembers having to pay out of pocket to travel from Edmonton to Winnipeg to attend the group's meetings. That $50 ticket broke me every time I went, Alex told Michel Lavelle. I had to take money out of the family to do that, so we would be on soup for a week. So despite their success, it was a financial struggle to create and show. And then, something happened that altered the group's ability to self-organize.
Well, what happened?
Daphne sold her shop and moved to British Columbia.
She closed them down in 1976. She said, Stella, I have a lot of visitors come every day. I can't paint. I can't produce painting anymore. That's why she left the gallery, closed the gallery, sold it.
Everybody was kind of leaving the area. In 77, I'm already in down south.
Joseph returned to the United States in 1975. For a time, he traveled back and forth to Manitoba.
So just the physical distance, you know, and there's always a lot of difficulty contacting Norval and Carl. So, you know, the collective by then, I think we're without having meetings and without having Daphne's shop, we weren't really doing as much as we could. It was pretty much starting to wind down. We had just different little shows here and there.
The group would continue to exhibit together through 1977, but the shows weren't resulting in the growth they had anticipated.
There was really a lot of interest in the big three.
Norval, Daphne, Alex.
So that generated a lot of exhibitions. People wanted to have exhibitions, which I don't think we took a lot of them. But we weren't getting the larger venues, the major galleries that we had thought we could get into.
And then in 1978...
What I had heard is that he was murdered. And murdered in some sort of party situation.
Carl Ray was killed.
You know, and that he was left to freeze to death in the snow. That was kind of what was told me, you know. I don't really know, and even today I've tried to find out more about what really happened to him. But it seems that, you know, it was his own people. You know, people that he knew and partied with. And they were just in an alcohol-fused craziness. They stabbed him and left him to freeze to death outside.
In our research for this series, we couldn't find a news article or obituary that gave the details of Carl's death. But the details that are repeated are that on September 28, 1978, Carl was stabbed in a bar fight in Sioux Lookout, Ontario. Shortly after, he died in hospital. He left behind 110 paintings, the creative output of his 35 years on this earth. In the wake of his death, a series of cross-Canada exhibitions were held to raise money for his widow Helen and their children.
You know, that was a time that kind of signified probably an end of the group when Carl was taken out.
In April 1979, just 7 months after Carl's death, the Professional Native Indian Artist Inc. officially dissolved according to Corporations Canada.
It really was quite a short-lived group.
This is National Gallery curator Michel Lavelle.
And but what they aimed to achieve 1980s as one of the first, you know, self-organized activist artist groups. Their experiences and the groundwork they laid really set things in motion for artist groups in general moving forward.
Despite no longer operating as a cohesive collective, various members did still exhibit their work together in the early 1980s, and their individual profiles continued to grow. However, on December 8, 1984, they would suffer another significant loss with the untimely passing of one of the principal architects of the PNIAI, Jackson Beardy.
He died of a heart attack. He was 40.
This is Jackson's widow, Paula.
He'd been sick on and off for a few years. It was a direct relationship to alcohol abuse. He was getting chest pain, so he went to the hospital, and basically they diagnosed him having an MI, and he was put in intensive care. And he wasn't eating. And he said, you know, he wasn't going to live. And so he just told me to go home and look after our son, Jason. And he died shortly after that. It was directly related to alcoholism. And as you know, a lot of residential school children died from alcohol-related problems.
Yeah, it was, you know, that symbolizes kind of the problem of not only within the group, you know, like Norval suffered a lot from alcoholism and being kind of taken advantage of. They would party hard when they came to the city.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In 1979, Maclean's magazine published a feature entitled The New Age of Indian Art. It was published after Carl's death and the shocking death of Ojibwe artist Benjamin Chichi, but before Jackson's passing. In it, writer Christopher Hume reports that following Norval Morisot's 1962 debut, more than 100, quote, Indian artists are exhibiting in galleries across Canada. Here, read this part.
So Hume writes, it's nothing less than a renaissance, or perhaps as some would have it, the last great outpouring of a dying culture.
So which was it?
What?
Well, was it a renaissance or the outpouring of a dying culture? I'm kidding. Here, just listen to this clip from an interview Jackson did in 1980.
My way of saying things at the visual level says what language cannot say. And I think that in itself, by my visual interpretation, they can relearn the traditions. And also, it forms a natural communication level between all cultures. I'm a medium from generations back.
It started as taboo for artists like Dorval Morisot, Carl Rae, and Jackson Beardy to depict their people's stories and teachings through their work. But by the time this article was published, some 20 years after Norval began this kind of work, Jackson had filmed a segment for Sesame Street in which he teaches his son Jason the story of the Thunderbirds.
Sometimes Jason and I draw pictures and tell stories. We're going to draw pictures of Thunderbirds. There are different kinds of Thunderbirds which make different kinds
and by
of
extension,
weather.
Teaches all the children watching Sesame Street that same lesson. So in just this short period, it had evolved from taboo to something to be shown in 1970s pop culture.
Oh, cool.
This was not an outpouring of a dying culture. This was a vital act of continuity, resistance, and resilience. And one of the lasting and most visible legacy of the PNIAI is the woodland style of art.
Norval wasn't really crazy about the term woodland art. It was coined by a reporter in a magazine in the 70s.
This is Corey Dingle of the Morisot Estate.
He didn't create that name or have anything to do with that name, but you know, now he's considered the origin of the woodland school of art.
That there was not a woodland school before Norval, you know, and I think the members inspired art that did not have to be within the boundaries of Western European aesthetics or isms. You know, indigenous people have been creating for millennia. We don't need, colonizers to describe how we communicate with each other or to our creator or to make it into another ism.
The Woodland School of Art, as it's known, has its roots in birch bark scrolls that date back 400 years in First Nations culture. Norval took inspiration from this traditional method of knowledge transfer and translated it into another medium. Typically, woodland work is oral traditions translated into a visual medium. It's characterized by its use of bright or earthy colors, heavy black lines, lines of movement, power, and communication, which connect figures within a composition. Duality is a major theme in the works of woodland artists, whether it be between animal and man, or man and spirit, or First Nations spirituality and Christianity. Another major stylistic feature of woodland art is the use of a kind of X-ray imagery. The artist draws the outline of a figure, a loon, say, but its body reads almost like an X-ray image, showing its inner spiritual life.
And so all of a sudden, now we have this, you know, connection of drawing spirituality, drawing, you know, non-Christian-based religions. And so it almost like a whole nother tree sprung up right beside another tree of art. It infused a whole other genre, in a sense, a whole nother perspective onto the larger Canadian art scene, where at that time it was old masters and, you know, white people painting trees, basically, right? Woodland art is in the same vein of surrealism, impressionism. It gave us a whole new different language to play with.
Of the members of the PNIAI, Norval, Carl, Jackson, Eddie, and Daphne are all recognized as woodland painters. The first generation also included artists like Benjamin Chi-Chi and Roy Thomas. And there have been subsequent generations, which include Blake Randolph DeBosque, Bob Boyer, Frank Paulson, Christian Morisot, and Brent Hardesty.
Those are the group, the second generation, which one educated from the school. Their work right now is outstanding, the difference than the group of talents. So many of the talents right now is there. We should be proud of what we have, and the world appreciate it.
This is Bonnie Devine.
And suddenly they began to be seen as intelligent, active, you know, entrepreneurial, talented, forward-thinking, you know, all of those things that, of course, they were. But there had been a screen in front of them that prevented people from really discerning who they were. And I think that that has endured. That hole that they made, that they pierced through that screen, has stayed open. And many, many other artists, including myself, were able to pass through there and begin to participate in the contemporary art world in a meaningful, productive way.
They came together for a relatively short time, but had a big impact. What they did in coming together led to the organization, groups like SCANA, the Society of Canadian Artists of Native Ancestry, which included members like Carl Beam, Gerald McMaster, Edward Poitra, Joan Cardinal Schubert. So these kinds of very important figures that were the second wave, really, of what PNIAI did as a group in organizing as artists to take things into under their own control, to demand access to galleries and to collections, to create exhibitions. There weren't those opportunities, and to really fight for it.
There and their contemporary art was really creating this excitement on the contemporary art scene. They were portraying reality of Indigenous peoples from their own perspectives, and really got the wheels rolling so that everybody could move on to the next stage as a result.
This is Michelle Lavallée again.
Yeah, like their influence definitely continues to inspire. Many artists have taken up mentoring, just even through mimicking the style. They demonstrated not only the resilience and the permanence and the existence of First Nations culture, but just the continued presence as creative sources, you know, rooted in their culture, rooted in the multicultural world of today. And really looking to inspire people, even beyond their community.
So what happened to the PNIAI after the 1980s?
Well, Joseph, of course, and Alex are still with us. Eddie passed away in 1996, Norval in 2007, and Daphne in 2016. But their works remain. In 2006, Norval was the subject of the first major solo exhibition of a First Nations artist at the National Gallery of Canada. This is Greg Hill.
And that was through, partially through the lobbying efforts of artists all along and groups that we're talking about, but also it came down, I'm thinking particularly of a meeting between Leanne Martin and Jim Logan from Canada Council and myself and Pierre Taberge, where they advocated for this to happen, and he said yes. And it was like, oh, okay, our meeting's over, and what's next? So I had, because I was an assistant curator at the National Gallery at that time, to say, okay, well, here, make the proposal to do the Norval Morisseau exhibition. Pierre Taberge calls me into his office, submitted a proposal to do the show, and, you know, I'm an untested green curator at the gallery, kind of on the bottom rung of the curatorial ladder there, and he just basically said, can you do this? And of course, I didn't really know, but I had to summon up all of my confidence and say yes, and then I had to figure it out.
Norval Morisseau, Shaman Artist, ran from February 3rd to April 30th, 2006, and contained 60 original pieces by Morisseau.
So that show meant a lot to the history of the institution in terms of finally doing that commitment. what it signaled to artists, contemporary artists working, that here one of our very important senior artists is finally being honored at this institution, so that there is that recognition, and I think that instills a kind of hope, or that there's that possibility that can actually happen for, you know, another artist practicing at the time.
Corey Dengel.
Like, you know, and I'm being cheeky, I know, but if I went to any other country and we weren't dealing with the indigenous aspect of it, and I said, your National Gallery hasn't done a show of your greatest artist that you've ever produced yet? Of course we do. We've done like 10.
A retrospective of Daphne's work followed in 2009, and one on Alex Janvier in 2016. All three of these artists, it's worth noting, received the Order of Canada before ever being featured at the National Gallery.
How close together were their awards?
Norval received his in 1978, Daphne in 86. Alex received his Order of Canada just a mere 7 years before his National Gallery show.
So what does this show us?
Well, there are still systemic issues facing Indigenous artists today, a second-class citizenship, not the least of which is seen through the valuation of their work.
If we talk about just price per painting, we get multiple times the money in a contemporary setting than we do in an Indigenous setting. We have Indigenous auctions of Indigenous art. If you're an Indigenous person, you're in an Indigenous auction. And sadly, that Indigenous auction gets a fraction of value attained to it than a contemporary auction. And why is that? Why do we celebrate when an Indigenous painting, like we had a record-breaking sale a month ago of one of Norval's works for around $360,000. Why is that celebrated as an amazing feat when a Harris goes for $7 million?
That's Lauren Harris, a member of the original Group of Seven.
Harris is a fantastic artist, but he's not Norval Morrison in that sense. As legacy goes, as contributions to society goes.
And then there's the issue of forgery.
I'm involved with the group, the Norval Morrison Heritage Society, which was mandated by Norval in 2005 to try to address specifically head on this problem of forgeries of his work. And there were forgeries of his work for decades before then. But it was a small problem, and it was a problem that he didn't want to do anything about, because in some cases, you know, it could be a family member. So it's out of, you know, these are acts of desperation.
But then,
and then these thousands of forgeries being really, really awful paintings, which drag down Morisot's legacy. So the scale of that process, of that, you know, of forgeries of his work is unbelievable, and it's criminal, right? So we recognize that when we become aware of it.
Canada doesn't have any resources that they wish to lend to the art world to help us determine scientifically if a painting is fake or not. We can say all the things that we want to say, but if nobody saw the painting get forged, then it doesn't matter who says what, the painting's real. And if we say it's fake, we get sued. And even recently, we told an organization that two paintings that you have for sale, we believe are suspect. And we even have the side-by-side comparison of the original painting and the fake painting. And these paintings are so horribly done. It's so obvious. and they threatened to sue us. So how do we clean up the market?
But the story of the Morisseau forgeries could be a whole other series. If listeners wish to see the PNIAI's work together, there's a place to go. And that's at the Museum of Aboriginal Peoples Arts and Artifact in Lac La Biche, Alberta.
So we are the only museum anywhere in the world that has a permanent collection on display of the professional Native Indian artistry.
That's Donna Felidichuk.
It started with Donna Felidichuk when she took over the museum. As it was a teaching collection, it was kind of not being administered. So she took it over and really put some heart into it. And it started by she was hanging all this work that nobody had ever seen. So she started hanging it in the halls of the college. And that became the genesis of a new museum.
So in terms of a collection in our institution, the group is hugely important. So the group is our cornerstone for all of our collections and really important to our program here at the institution. I mean, they are the ones, the individuals that were in the forefront that are kind of the foundation of visual arts. So when you go to a normal art museum, you're going to have gallery spaces. Usually you have to stand quite a ways back from the works. Our works are in the hallway of our building. You can get, 2 inches, an inch away from it. And when I talked to Alex and Joseph, that was really important to them because it made the work accessible to people, right? You can get up to it. You can see it. You can spend the time with it that you need to spend with it. You can feel the spirituality of them.
Given the origins of the group and their focus on youth and the future, it seems fitting that it's a teaching collection.
It's an interesting thing with what's happened to Native art. I rely a lot on hope that all these new young academics step up to the plate, go back to a bit of authenticity, because if you get a master's, there's a bit of a trade-off to the master. The master always wants you to do his work first and be like him before you can get to yourself. And for a Native artist, that self can be completely lost in the isms of Western European fantasies about what art is. You know, I encourage young artists to listen to nature, get out of our consumer society. Try not to be enticed by what I call the colonizer's gifts. Don't be kind of wined and dined that you forget, in a sense, where you come from. And above all, please share your work and your success with your own people. You know, we're used to be community groups, but, you know, we live in a society that honors the individual. The art world wants art heroes. So we'll take one of you, but the rest of you are not welcome. This was something that the group itself thought about in those days, and it's even worse today. It's more important to share your work with more people. Bring everybody with you.
So how do we wrap this up?
Well, I think we need to give Joseph the last word.
Well, there was one thing that I wanted to add about the dissolution of the group. Why did the group ultimately dissolve? And the group did not dissolve. The corporation papers did not get refiled. So this dissolution was like a government-based thing. And it wasn't like any kind of consensus of the members of the group. You know, I think our corporate entity just kind of sailed off into the sunset of time. But the seven of us, we banded together to change Canada's perception of its art. So we became friends, comrades, spiritual souls, forever in our minds and hearts.
Among Equals is a special presentation of Knockabout Media and has been made possible by the Government of Canada. It's hosted by me, Soleil Lounière, and produced by Ryan Barnett, Maya Foster-Sanchez, and Naka Bertrand. Our series advisors are Joseph M. Sanchez and Donna Filadichuk. This series features interviews with Bonnie Devine, Greg A. Hill, Michelle Lavallée, Carmen Robertson, Pauline Beardy, Philip Gavick, Corey Dingle, Donna Filadichuk, and Joseph M. Sanchez. Special thanks to Eric Berendt at the Indigenous Arts Center. Our series artwork is by Caleb Ellison-Dysart, with additional work by Carlene Harvey. For a list of sources used in this series and to download the listening guide, visit knockaboutmedia.com.
A Knockabout Media original.
Hold on.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.